Hi, welcome to the show. How about you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Elliot Grant. I'm one of the founders of Lunar Studios, and we make a game called Prismata.
Okay. And for the audience out there, can you also first mention the site where they can learn more about Prismata?
So you can go to prismata.net. It's PRISMATA.net. We have a blog. There's a subreddit where people talk about the game. There's lots of information out there. We just did a Kickstarter last month. And there's a ton of info on that page as well.
Okay. And can you describe to the audience what the game is about?
So Prismata is kind of a weird game that lies in between a couple of well-established genres. It looks a bit like a card game, but there's actually no cards, no decks, no collecting. It plays a little bit like a real-time strategy game, but it's turn-based. And so you have to kind of imagine, instead of a game like Civ, where you have this giant board and you move all your guys around it, there's no board, and you can play your turns very quickly in only a few seconds. And you sort of build up your economy, you build attackers and defenders. There's a combat system in the game that's very simple, and you battle your opponent. And there's dozens and dozens of different units in the game, and you get to play with different units every time you play. And so it feels a little bit like a combination of a strategy game. Like an RTS or a card game, and a little bit like it's very much influenced by tabletop games, like particularly European board games or deck building games like Dominion, that sort of thing.
And you mentioned it's kind of a, I mean, so there is a card element to the game too, right? Or is it?
Well, you could
What else?
build the exact same game without any cards at all. There's no decks. But the way the game is sort of visually designed, it looks a bit like a card game. The units on the table, they're placed in these rectangular card-like things, and they're sort of set up in stacks. But the game itself, it doesn't have any of the card draw mechanics that you see in like online collectible card games.
And what inspired you to make this game?
Well, this game, it came from it was a summer almost 5 years ago, so I guess 4.5 years ago. It was the summer in between finishing my undergrad and starting my master's. And so I had a bunch of time, and a lot of my friends were in a similar boat, and we just spent the whole summer playing games. And we actually liked to develop a lot of different types of games. When we would play a board game, one of the things we would often do is like try and modify the rules to usually make it more hardcore, but often just to make it more interesting or more compelling in some way. And I think the idea for Prismata came about when we were playing a lot of StarCraft and a lot of Dominion, and a couple of my friends, they also played a lot of Magic the Gathering. And it was sort of like taking a number of ideas from different games, because I think StarCraft 2 had just come out. And so we were into that at the time. And it was sort of taking a lot of different ideas from different games and combining them to make a new type of game that removed a lot of the frustrations or the things that we saw as like the decreasing the amount of skill in the game. And so for us, it was like in a lot of card games, the card draw has so much luck that you can be the better player and still lose, or you can end up in situations that are unwinnable just because your opponent got a better draw than you. And in games like StarCraft, there's Fog of War, which hides what your opponent's doing, and you can sort of get these build order losses just by being unlucky. And originally, we were driven by the idea of removing those types of elements and making a pure strategy game that had no randomness and no hidden information or Fog of War to create a sort of pure strategy game that had modern game design principles. So it's almost like a game like chess, where you take turns with your opponent, you both make a move, you know exactly what's going on, and you can think very deeply about the situation. But chess is a game that's very alienating to a lot of people, because you actually, you have to think 10 moves ahead, and there's all this deep opening theory that you have to memorize if you want to get good. And so the idea was to find ways to remove that by using a lot of the principles in modern games, the way they're designed. And so that was, I think, how we got started originally. Originally, it was a card game that we played on a tabletop. It wasn't until like a year later where we had a a somewhat competent digital version of the game that we were playing online. There's a number of stories I can tell about that, but that's sort of where it all began. It's just us experimenting with a new game design idea.
So during that summer, you said you and your friends were playing a lot of games. Was it just mainly, I mean, what types of genres of games? I know you mentioned some of them. Were there other? Was it just? Were you just trying to explore the whole landscape of all the different genres, or was it mainly, StarCraft type games, RTS type games, European tabletop games?
Well, I think strategy games, as a sort of king genre among genres, would cover most of the types of games we would play. But it was everything from strategy card games, RTS, a lot of board games, card games, also a lot of like puzzles and puzzle games, like more abstract things like Space Cam or I mean, I'm a fan of like classic Nintendo games. Every Mario and Zelda I've played through. But this was like the summer that we played a ton of really competitive games and tried to play them all at a really high level or get really good at them. And we were compelled by the idea of getting good at a strategy game and exploring what mechanics made a strategy game that people could get really good at or sort of develop a high amount of skill at.
So, for the audience out there, can you maybe reduce or summarize some of the concepts that you recognized as important to good strategy games?
Well, I think variety in the types of situations you end up in is really important. Like the reason chess is really alienating to a lot of people is like, you have to memorize all these openings and all of the responses to your opponent's choice of openings or their responses to your responses. And so we wanted a game where every single situation felt new and different and gave you different opportunities to sort of win through strategic choices rather than memorizing a studied or previously studied opening. We also, there's a lot of things like we have time controls that make it really tight, so you don't sit there for 20 minutes agonizing over a move. The game tree is very broad, so you can't look 5 moves ahead. There's really no way to do that because there's just so many options for you and your opponent. And a lot of the decision making you make is sort of rather than tactical, I do this, your opponent does that. It's very strategic in that you kind of think, well, I want to have a big economy this game, or I want to have a small economy, or I want to be really aggressive, or I want to counter my opponent's aggression by being defensive. And a lot of the choices that you make in the game are more strategic and less tactical, and they're sort of less demanding of players. And we took inspiration from a lot of card games, Magic the Gathering. Where players don't often make exact calculations about what's going to happen in a couple turns, but they make educated guesses based on what could happen or what the sort of possibilities are. And the way those games feel, they're very different than a strategy game like chess. But there's of course a problem in that those games, card games where you're drawing cards every turn, they're so random that often you don't get rewarded for your good decisions. And we really wanted to make a game where you'd be rewarded for your good decisions. So we sort of we centered around this idea of a fast-paced game that's different every time you play it and is more strategic and less tactical. I think the overall shape and structure of the game is very much inspired by RTS, the idea that you start out with a small number of workers, you can build structures that produce other types of resources or give you access to other technologies, and you make choices about which type of tech you want to invest in. And that was a big inspiration for us for sure.
And so you wanted to explore a certain game concept, and so you and some other people built up, I guess, a physical version of this idea.
Right. So,
Okay.
I mean, this is a great way to prototype a game,
Yeah.
especially a strategy game. Get a stack of sticky notes or index cards and actually make the game that way.
And so when you were doing that, how long did it take to come up with that first physical prototype? And what were some of the surprises or realizations you had as you started playing that?
The very first version of the game, we actually still have the cards. My friend Will sort of went home and made them. And I think there were only like 4 or 5 different units in the game. And they were all very simple. There's a drone. At the time, it was called a peasant. It costs 4 gold and makes 1 gold a turn. There's a footman. It costs six gold and attacks for one a turn. And, you know, there's a barracks which you need to have in order to make footmen and stuff like that. It was very, very simple. And the thing that actually blew our minds, you know, we made games like this all the time. We came up with ideas or modifications of the game. And a lot of the time we played them once or twice and that was it. This game, we found, even though it was so simple, was just incredibly compelling. It was like we had discovered this, you know, deep, dark well full of secrets, and we just wanted to keep going deeper and finding more about the game. And the mechanics were so simple, but we spent all this time, like, studying different strategies and different openings and making modifications to the balance of the units, and it became this obsession that the game itself just was really, really good. And, you know, it wasn't like we created it. It was more like we discovered it. We sort of happened upon a set of game mechanics that produced something really, really compelling, way more compelling than we had initially thought. And that was what sort of inspired us to pursue it further.
Okay. So you discover this rule set that has some interesting properties. And so did you start testing it with maybe other people outside the small group that, you know, conceived the idea or discussed it initially, or?
Well, I think what happened is our initial small group of people was maybe three or four people, and then we added a few more, five, six, seven, eight people, and many of those went on to become our initial dev team. For a while, there were six of us who were regularly making new units, doing sort of weekly play tests, and it was that fall after the summer that my buddy Will started at MIT. I didn't start till a year later, but there was a year while he was at Boston at MIT, I was still in Canada, and we actually would play online, and we didn't have an online client. We would relay our moves to each other using this, like, completely absurd and nonsensical notation that we had invented to just play the game with each other over Instant Messenger. And we would spend hours and hours playing this game over, like, you know, MSN Messenger or Google Chat or whatever it was at the time. And I was obsessed with the game. I was, like, drawing openings in my notebooks. Like, it was pretty crazy.
Okay. And so then at that time, was that probably maybe when you recognized that you might want to do an online client, or what? Yeah, what happened after the fall?
So the online client was started by my friend David Ree, who is another one of our developers. He used to do a lot of, like, game jams, you know, the Ludendare stuff or 48-hour game competition, stuff like that. And I think it was over a Christmas break or something like that, he was like, at a place with no internet for a week, staying with his parents or something like that. And he made a very basic computer version of the game in Game Maker. And, you know, it wasn't even online. You had to have two players sitting in the same laptop. And he later made it online, but you had to, like, type in your opponent's IP address to connect to them. It was very limited. It obviously didn't have any graphics. They were all stolen from Google Image Search. And, you know, horrifically ugly colors and very poor user experience in terms of the actual user interface. But it allowed us to play the game, and it was great, and we were still addicted to it. And so we were using his version for a while. And we discovered it was actually very difficult to add new features, because it was like a bit of a hack job. We cobbled together all of the code to make stuff work, but then if we wanted to change the rules or add a unit to the game that had different rules than the existing units, it was often really difficult to make it work. So what we switched to for prototyping is this software called Magic Workstation. And Magic Workstation is a program that people use to test and prototype decks for Magic the Gathering. But more or less what it lets you do is it lets you have a battlefield, put rectangular cards on them, and, like, sort of draw arrows between the cards or turn them sideways or put counters on them, stuff like that. And that was more or less enough for us to be able to play the game online with each other. And, of course, it came with online capabilities. So that was actually the tool that we used for prototyping. And we had, like, 100 different units in Magic Workstation. And whenever we wanted to add a new unit with new rules, we would just add it to the file of units that we had, and we didn't have to program the rules because we ourselves were enforcing them rather than having a game client do it for us.
Yeah. And so once you had that setup going, what was the next step? What were you and some of the other people discussing or thinking about? Were you just going to leave it at that point and just play it through that tool, or what were you thinking?
Well, I think at the time, a lot of us were playing Dominion Isotropic, which is an online server for the game Dominion, which has since gone down and been replaced by an official game server for Dominion. But at the time, there was this unofficial server for it, and it was actually really awesome. You could go online, get matched against an opponent, play whatever. And it was sort of a small community project, but it had, a few hundred users. If you went online at a random time, you could get a match without having to wait that long. And we kind of thought that, well, it would be cool if this game could have a server like that, where people could sort of log in and play each other and blah, blah, blah. We never really intended to turn it into a big game or try to make any money off of it. It was mostly just the idea, could this be online somehow? And I think it was that winter break. So the game started, it was summer 2010. And so this would have been at the end of 2011, so a year and a half after we started. The entire dev team got together. We were all in Waterloo, Ontario, and we did like a week-long hackathon to try and make an actual website where you could play the game. And so I wrote a server for the game. And David and some of the other guys worked on the client side. And initially, it ran on the University of Waterloo Computer Science Club website. Like, we didn't ever have any official server or anything like that. But it was just running on the school computer, basically. And we had the client. And again, all the graphics were stolen. There was no art in the game, anything like that. But you could go to a website and log in and play. And they were like, the interface, there was an auto matcher. It had a bunch of tables, and you like sit down at a table, and your opponent would sit down, and you could play against your opponent. And it was a lot of fun. And that was more or less the version that has over the years morphed into the final version that we see today. Although probably almost every line of code has been rewritten at some point. That was sort of the genesis of it all.
What tools did you use to develop those online, like that online version on that site? Was that something where you built it in Flash, or were you developing downloadable clients at that time, or what were your thoughts?
Yeah, so initially we started in Flash for the client side. The client side is actually still mostly written in ActionScript 3 with a bit of C++. But I think David was just more experienced with Flash than any of the alternatives.
Oh,
So we just built it in Flash. And I think this is advice I would echo to anybody out there. Just use whatever tools you're comfortable with, especially when you're prototyping, because you can always switch to something else later. And for the server side, none of us had written a web server before ever. And I did a bit of research into it, and we ended up using a platform called Twisted. Twisted is a Python library, and it's more or less, it's one of those asynchronous libraries that you could use to write an online chat server in literally 5 minutes. It's very good for precisely the task of making an online game where you have a small number of players connected to each individual game instance. And I would highly recommend Twisted for anybody who wants to make like a turn-based online game. I don't know about real time, whether the latency would be too much. I think it probably would still work. But for a turn-based online game with a small number of players, I would definitely go with Twisted. It saves us so much time whenever we want to implement anything. So that framework worked out really well for us.
And after that, you have this thing on a website. Did you start opening it up to maybe more players to get more feedback, or what happened right after that?
Well, for a long time, it was really just our own group of developers. So I think that was around the start of 2012 when we finally had it online. And it was mostly in 2012. At that time, I had moved to MIT as well. So we actually had a house where most of the dev team was living. So it was me and Will and our friend Shalev. And at some point, our friend David also came to MIT a year later and was in the same house again. So we would just hang out many times a week or on the weekends or whatever, the evenings, just playing the game. And through playing the game, we would develop new units and new ideas for different game mechanics. And we weren't really working on like the user interface or the art or anything like that. We were working on the fundamental rule set of the game and the costs of all the units and stuff like that, just to develop a single compelling 1v1 mode for the game. And we toyed around with other modes too, like deck building modes or like PvE modes where you could team up with your allies and even stuff 2v2, and we never got around to implementing 2v2, but we did implement some of the other modes and we're testing them out, and we had a lot of fun with those as well. And I think it was at the start of 2013, January 2013, where we really started showing the game to a lot of our friends, and we got feedback that was way more phenomenal than I had ever expected. And you know how sometimes you show a game to your friend and they go, "Well, it's pretty good." And you know, they're sort of just being nice to you. For us, what happened is I showed the game to several of my friends, and they went home and taught their friends to play it and played it almost every day for months. And so, you know, it wasn't just they were being nice to us, it was they were actually like hooked on the game, as hooked as we are or we were during those first few weeks or months when we were working on the game. And many of them actually still play the game all the time. So you know, it was feedback in the form of people are playing the game and are liking it and are telling other people about it. And that was just great.
And so then what were you thinking? If people are responding to this, were you, I mean, did your team have a like maybe broader plans or consider maybe, you know, like doing it as like as more of like a enterprise or something else like that or?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always a dream, right? Like you're sitting there with this game that you yourself really love, and you think, "Oh, what could this become?" And many of our friends, they were asking us the same thing: "Yo, when's it coming out?" And of course, I was still in school at the time, and so was Will. I was midway through a PhD, and you know, up until that point, I'd mostly been pursuing an academic career. I'd worked in a couple of startups, and so I had actual experience running a startup company or working with people who are running a startup company. So I more or less knew what it would entail to turn it into an actual business. But you know, it's like a major life decision to quit school, and we talked about it endlessly, and you know, how would we get funding? What would we do if it didn't work out? And, you know, I talked to my PhD supervisor, and you know, he said, "Well, you know, go do it for a year, whatever. If it doesn't work out, you can always come back." And so, you know, I can, in theory, go back to MIT anytime. I have the form somewhere filed away that I can submit to them to get back in school. But right now, I'm hoping to stick with the gaming, and it has turned out to be a great decision. Even if it doesn't work out that well, I've learned so much from doing it. And I think there were a couple of big things that led to our decision ultimately to go through with it, to quit school and try and actually turn this game into a proper release. One was the feedback we were getting, but also a lot of that feedback was in the form of like, "Yo, if you guys make a company, I'll invest in it." And, you know, when you have people who are playing the game and are actually like throwing money at you, you know, it becomes a bit more compelling. And so what we ended up doing is we sort of asked around a bunch of friends, you know, are people actually interested in doing this? And a number of them said yes. And we talked amongst ourselves as the developers, can we sort of pool our own personal wealth, which, you know, for me as a student wasn't really that much, but, you know, for a game like this, it's not like we have a multi-million dollar budget. But you know, we had between us enough cash to get started and a bit of friends and family who wanted to lend help, and we realized, wow, this could actually be feasible. So that worked out really well. A number of our founders actually play quite a bit of online poker, so they had a bit of money from that. Many of them have friends who had even more money from playing a lot of online poker. So that was actually a source of a number of our sort of friend and family investors are actually poker players. And you know, they knew that we were competent people and working on something that had a good reputation among a number of friends in their community. So they were willing to invest, and that was what allowed us to get started. Another thing that happened was it was 2013 in March when Hearthstone got announced. And you know, Will and David were actually at PAX East, which is the conference where it was announced. And I remember when that happened, you know, it was like a whirlwind of emotions because, like, oh God, if we do this, we're going to have this huge amount of competition. But at the same time, we recognized it is actually benefiting us because, you know, Blizzard's a huge company, and if they can make a collectible card game, that sort of proves two things. One is that they think the market is correct to release such a thing.
Yeah.
And two is that they have generated a huge amount of interest in a genre that up until that point was pretty niche. You know, Hearthstone's now a mainstream game or a top 10 game. And the amount of interest they've generated is such that a game like ours is more financially feasible than it might have been a couple of years earlier, because there are people who like Hearthstone and they're willing to try other games that seem similar to it.
Okay. And so then you're saying around maybe the spring or at the end of spring 2013, you started to do this full time?
Well, I think what happened was we made the decision in that summer and, you know, submitted the forms. Will and I both, it was the fall of 2013 where we were no longer enrolled in school. So I think September 2013 was when we were actually doing this full time. I think November 15th of that year was when we officially got incorporated, you know, which is, you know, just filing some papers away. But, you know, we had to actually like call up lawyers and, you know, accountants and you can do that stuff yourself, but it's, you know, more or less recommended not to. And I had talked to a number of people in startups and in gaming, you know, literally every person I could reach out to try and get advice on how to not run my company into the ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, tons and tons of people gave me really good advice. And I would recommend that to anybody before you start your own business of any kind. Just talk to as many people as you can who have done it before. And people you can meet up with for a coffee or a phone call, or even just ask people on Reddit or whatever you can do. Because there's so many like little things that people told me that have amounted to a huge amount of value in starting this company. And so I think we got our office April 2014. We actually, our first hire, was January of last year, and we hired three people. We hired one developer, one artist, and one AI guy.
Okay. And, you know, going back to some of the suggestions that you got from, you know, the community and other places on ways to run your company more effectively, do you have like maybe three or five, I guess, pieces of wisdom that really did help you significantly, I guess, avoid any kind of landmines as you started out?
Yeah, so Gabe Newell's answer to this question is get a good lawyer, and he doesn't say that with any amount of irony. You know, that's I think it's a good piece of advice. I've read so many stories about people who've done things that are questionable or scary and have resulted in all kinds of problems down the road. You know, like even when we were trying to find the name of our game, we would do all these like trademark searches and stuff like that. There's just a huge number of potential issues that you want to avoid. I think hiring is the most important decision you'll ever make when you're starting your own company. Like it's a decision that you gotta spend a lot of time on. And in particular, like for developer positions, learning how to interview people well. You know, and learning about how to balance the need for people who have specific skills versus people who are just generally competent or people who have a good fit with your team is very important. Learning to prioritize well, I think on a day-to-day basis, prioritizing is the most important decision that I make as a guy running a company. Like there's all kinds of things that are screaming for my attention, and sometimes you just got to ignore them because they're actually not that important or actually don't generate any value for the company or whatever. I think listening to your community, like we very much follow sort of a lean startup methodology in that we don't, like a lot of game developers, they want to build the whole game and finish it and then release it to the public. And what we do is we incrementally add features to the game, often in a really hackish or poorly implemented manner, and then ask people for feedback. And based on their feedback, we'll build a better version of it. Like when we added tournaments to our game, we had a 30-hour hackathon to add tournaments to Prismata. And we did it, and they kind of sucked, but they were good enough that people were actually using them to have tournaments, and they could have tournaments in the game using our tournament feature. And we got a ton of feedback that we used to gradually improve them, and they're going to undergo even more improvements in the future. So the sort of like, you know, in startup culture, they say a lot of things like build a minimum viable prototype. And that's in gaming, that doesn't quite work because, you know, you actually need to build a game in order for people to have an experience with it that's a good one. And often by building a crappy version of a game, you actually don't get the feedback that you need. But for things like, you know, game systems and metagame features and things like user progression, the game, stuff like that, a lot of this you can prototype cheaply. And things like, you know, there's not much art in the game. Even now, we're still, you know, the progress bar is one-third full on the art. And it's because we really want to know what people want or what drives people's interest in a game before we expend a lot of effort on it. And we try really hard to keep our team small and make sure we can sort of handle everything that we're trying to do. At the same time, we also talk to experts when necessary. Like if we need something related to our online server security, you know, we can still talk to an expert about that. And through developing a big community, we've gained access to all kinds of people who just, you know, randomly email us offering to help, and it's actually been great. And we try to tap into those resources as much as we can.
So going back to, you know, you talked about development hire and having this right balance of culture fit, specific knowledge or skill set, and then also general competence. You know, how did you go about finding someone with, you know, with that right mix? Because, you know, there are people who can be really smart, but they may not even be necessarily passionate about a specific game or a specific topic. There are people who have the right skill set, but they may not, you know, be able to scale to other types of new things that you need to do to grow your business. And there are people who have the passion, but not necessarily the skill set to make it happen. Was there any technique that you used to find the right developers for this? Or?
I think,
go ahead. Yeah.
There's a blog called Joel on Software, and he, Joel Spolsky, the guy who runs that blog, I think he's written more about how to hire people than pretty much anybody else out there. And the vast majority of what he says, I consider to be good advice. You know, like our interviews for developer positions, they do kind of feel like coder interviews for a company like Google. Like we actually give people hard coding problems and force them to actually write code in the interview. If they do a good job writing code in the interview or you know, they at least get through a few problems that we send at them, then we can talk about a bit more about their passion and the other things. But the sort of first and foremost thing is like, you know, here's an easy problem. Can you code a solution to it in 5 minutes? Here's a hard problem. Can you reason about it and come up with the answer in a way that convinces me that you understand what you're talking about? And so we definitely do that. With regards to like culture fit and passion, we often look at people's past projects or we look at, you know, what people actually do for fun. A lot of the people that we interviewed, they had either worked on games in the past or were very passionate about specific games that were similar to the ones we're interested in. You know, many people sent us demos of games they had built. We had people who would like talk to GDC. We had people who worked for AAA publishers. In all honesty, many of them weren't that good at coding, which was kind of a shame. We talked to a lot of different people, and I think you can get an idea of whether somebody's passionate by sort of looking at what they actually do for fun or looking at what they actually are interested in. And you can have a conversation with them about games, and you know, they'll say things like, "Oh, I was diamond level in StarCraft and stuff like that." And you know, they know what they're talking about, and to actually get to diamond level in StarCraft, you have to like play the game a lot, right? So, you know, it means they're into it.
Did you try to reach out, I guess, to your community itself to find developers to help because they were already playing the game? I'm not sure if that's a good idea. They're just too into the game, but I mean, it's a thought. I was just wondering if you had any perspective on that.
at the time when we were doing a big hiring push, we didn't have a community, so that wasn't really an option. In the future, I would definitely consider it. And even now, we have a careers email that's always open. I read every single resume that gets sent through there. There are many people who are really, really passionate about like our game, and they really want to work for us. And you know, a lot of them really, even though they're passionate, they're not like qualified enough.
Sure.
And we take a lot of steps to keep our team small, and we really want to be careful before taking people on. So, you know, at the same time, I think in the future, there's definitely going to be some growth, assuming that things go well. And if I had to do more hiring, I would definitely look to our community for people who would be interested in joining our team or recommending other people who could join our team. I think it's a very good resource.
So getting back to, you mentioned that I think in early 2014, you started doing your first hires, right?
Right.
And so after that, what was the next step? And what's interesting is it sounded like you already had a working game before that. So was there really a need to do the hiring versus just start trying to get the community going and just, you know, because you had enough skill set where you could at least get something going. I mean, what was the, I guess, push to hire, like, you know, take on three more people?
Well, so we had a working game, but there's sort of a number of bottlenecks to growth. At the time, there was no computer opponent to the game, which meant that if you wanted to come in and play the game, you pretty much had to have somebody teach it to you. And you know, that's problematic for a number of reasons. But basically, we needed an AI in order to grow the game so that you could actually have missions to play against the computer or whatever. So the AI was kind of necessary. We tried to build one on our own. It was like not very good. So the guy we hired actually is the winner of the StarCraft AI competition from a couple of years ago. So, you know, he's a top-notch AI guy. We were totally down to have him. The other stuff, well, first of all, the game had no art. So we needed art in there to even, you know, be able to legally release the game without having Google image search art in there. So that obviously needed to happen. I mean, we could have drawn it in MS Paint or whatever and had developer art. There's actually a lot of people who say you shouldn't have any publicly viewable version of your game until it has final art, because the screenshots are there forever in Google. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think the value we got from getting a community early is worth more than any kind of future pain caused by people Googling the wrong screenshots of our game and getting old ones. But we were sort of cognizant of that, and we wanted it to at least be somewhat presentable.
Because otherwise the community wouldn't form in the first place, necessarily, because, you know, they don't get the sense that it's well-baked.
That's true. That's both true and false, because there's a number of people who play the game right now who I'm sure would still play it if it was drawn in MS Paint or drawn with crayons. But, you know, we do want to have some kind of decent appearance to the game, and it's going to get a lot better. It's, you know, like I said, it's like one third progress bar or something like that. And in terms of more development, like, we had no back end when we started. Really, it was you know, there were 8 tables you could sit down and play them. And in terms of having a scalable server, you know, that wasn't really going to be scalable. We needed a way to automatically match users and find opponents for them. We needed rating systems. And there were tons and tons of improvements to the game that we really wanted to go in there to make the game more fluid to play, less frustrating to play, an overall better experience. And we really spent a lot of that year refining the gameplay in terms of the UI, in terms of its responsiveness and how things displayed and performed. And you know, so now you have the ability to like swipe through units and you can clearly see all of the things that are happening on the board. It really did take a long time to get our user interface polished enough that we were happy with it. And I think the reason is because the game design is entirely new. We couldn't just copy an existing user interface from a similar game. We had to do a lot of innovating to solve problems relating to, you know, how do we how do we communicate this aspect of the game state to the player? And there were many times we actually had to scale back on our original design intents because we realized that communicating this to the player was just too difficult or too complicated or presented too much information at once. So we actually slimmed down on the game design, and we decided that certain like unit abilities we would save for future releases once we had a community that was more more established and more used to the actual game and its presentation. But I think overall we did pretty well in terms of the user interface and in terms of the features. I think we're most of the way there. We're still adding a lot of stuff relating to the progression of the game and the fact that you can unlock skins and emotes. Right now the game has no end game content really, other than ranking up on a ladder. And people are still playing it for days and days and days, but we really do want you to be able to keep unlocking stuff sort of forever as you keep playing the game more and more. And we will have more and more content as time goes on. We're also releasing actual new units in the game. Pretty much every month we release a pack of a few more. So that's always ongoing. And I don't know, that may continue forever. I don't think we'll ever really be done in terms of having everything in the game that we want to.
And, okay, so the development and that extended team helped to accelerate some of these things. Now, with any startup, there's the core product, and there's also these other things like distribution, monetization, and marketing. And along those lines, what did your team do, or what did you consider doing? I know you mentioned a Kickstarter campaign. What were your thoughts on that? Or were you even considering that? Were you just focused on the product at that point in early 2014 just to make sure that was perfect? Or did you try to do everything in parallel to converge?
Well, I think you can't design a product like this without having distribution and monetization in mind. I mean, distribution is almost a non-issue now that you can pretty much get anything good onto Steam, or you can, now the alpha is actually, we have a web version of it. And the reason we have that is mostly because it makes updates easier. We could easily have a downloadable client. We just haven't, we haven't made it available yet. And we could, we will.
In terms of distribution, it's also platform. I mean, would it have been effective to be on mobile? I mean, is it better to be on Steam? Is it better to just be off of those things? And that's one of the things I wanted to mention. Or like,
I could talk for a whole hour about this topic. Steam and mobile are both hard decisions, I think, for us. There's a number of developers that they feel if they can't get on Steam, then they have no way of being seen at all. And that may be true for a lot of like single-player games, for example. For a game like ours that's a multiplayer game, inherently has a bit of virality just because players want to play with their friends, Steam is less essential, and they take their 30% cut or whatever. So it's a question of whether or not the value you gain from being on Steam and being exposed to more people is worth the sort of decrease in revenue. And if you look at free-to-play games, if you look at the top 10 grossing free-to-play games in 2014, two of those 10 are on Steam, right? So League of Legends isn't, for example. Something like Hearthstone isn't. And though the two that are on Steam are they're Dota 2 and Counter-Strike, which are both owned by Valve. So literally it's only Valve's own games are on Steam in terms of like free-to-play games that are raking in a lot of dough, free-to-play PC games. So it's actually the case that a lot of games in our genre or in our sort of class of distribution are not on Steam. And in terms of being free-to-play, like that wasn't even a question. That was sort of... we looked at Scrolls, which is Mojang's collectible card game, and I think the big mistake they made was not being free-to-play. I think in general, in 2015, a game like ours just has to be free-to-play in order to be commercially successful, because you lose so many people who just aren't willing to put down the initial $10 or $20 or whatever to buy the game if you don't make it free-to-play. So that was there from the start. Mobile is interesting, because there's like we had a survey and we asked people, are you interested in playing a game on mobile? Rank on a scale from 1 to 7, and it was basically 75% ones, and of the 25% that remained, most of them were sevens. So there's clearly a group of our players who would play the game on mobile if it came out, and most of our players never would. And a lot of the value in mobile games, or a lot of the value that people get, is they do a giant ad spend. They get to the top of various top 10 lists. You know, for us, it would be like top 10 card games, top 10 strategy games. And they contain a lot of like social casino games or stuff like Clash of Clans. That's basically extremely casual. And it sort of needs to be that way for you to make money off of your ad spend, because you need every single person who sees your ad to basically want to play the game if you want to get it into the top 10. And then once it's in the top 10, you want to expose, you want to gain value from your exposure, and your exposure is to everybody. So literally the way app stores work strongly incentivizes casual games to do well on them. And I think in terms of a hardcore strategy game, Hearthstone is pretty much the only example of one that has done well on mobile. And it's not even doing that well. Like, it's not even in the top 10 card games on the App Store for iPad right now. So, like, it's unclear whether or not it's a good decision. And you do pay your portion to Apple just for being on the App Store. They take a 30% of your revenue. So the question is, do we get enough new users to offset the revenue lost by people who would pay less on tablet? And that's not even counting the cost of porting, which actually isn't that bad for us, because the game is designed in a way that we can port it to a tablet without too much difficulty. Like, we don't use right-click, for example. But still, as a non-trivial cost of porting, there's a question of whether or not it gets you any revenue anyway. I think as time goes on, we will start to see more like hardcore games or less casual games do better and better on mobile. Right now, the market's very young, and the sort of growth portion of the market is still very heavily weighted towards casual games. That may change in the future. So we always have our ear to the ground, so to speak.
And so Kickstarter, and so what if, Can you discuss maybe the Kickstarter campaign that you guys, I guess, pursued, and when you posted it, and what was the result, and did you find any other benefit besides the financing related to Kickstarter?
Yeah, I mean, for us, I guess we always wanted to do a Kickstarter, and we kind of felt that, like, there's a lot of games on Kickstarter. A lot of them don't do that well. And the reason is sort of because in order to do well, you almost need an audience before you get on Kickstarter. And in particular, the graphics really matter. We talked to, like, we tried to hire a PR firm to do PR for us. And we talked to many of them. And I was on the phone with a PR firm who basically said, you know, you shouldn't get a PR firm. Your game's never going to do well on Kickstarter. The only stuff that does well on Kickstarter nowadays are games by established studios, or games that are retro in feel and sort of exploit nostalgia in order to get a fan base that way. And, you know, so it was literally like they told us it couldn't be done. And the thing that allowed us to do it was having a giant community on Reddit. And that basically all started almost by accident. There's a long story relating to this too. I posted something on the Today I Fucked Up subreddit. We had like gone to a convention and blown a lot of money on it, and the mailing list that we had collected from that convention got deleted due to some problem with offline Google Docs. And so I posted about this, and the thread on Reddit like blew up. And somebody checked my post history and tried to figure out what game we were working on, because I had mentioned this in the post, and they posted, oh, it's this game Prismata. And people like swarmed our website and dumped their emails into our sign up for the beta list. And at the time, we had like a trailer on the website, which was a 2-minute long, you know, pretty crappy trailer that just had some screenshots and some text. It was very basic. People actually expressed interest in the game. They gave us our emails, and we started I think we had a subreddit that had been open since the summer, and people actually started going there and posting threads, and we gave keys to a bunch of people, and they actually started playing the game. And sort of from nowhere, this community materialized. And we hit the front page on Reddit 4 times in the span of a few months. You know, one of them was like somebody posted our load screen animation and it got upvoted to the front page of Reddit. And through all these things happening, it was like a snowball effect. And now we have a community of people who played the game. And we sort of thought, well, we should just get on Kickstarter as soon as we can, and sort of see how well we can do.
And so the PR, okay, so you decided to put that Kickstarter in. When did you start the Kickstarter campaign?
So the Kickstarter campaign began, I think, November 20th, 2 months ago. Okay. And sort of the month before that, we spent a lot of time preparing. We hired a videographer to shoot some interview footage of us. And we put the video together. We got a lot of materials together for the updates. And then November, December, we were just constantly responding to people doing updates. A lot of the work we also did was getting the back end in place so that we actually could give out keys to people who pledged on Kickstarter, because we wanted people who pledged to get instant access to the game. That was sort of our goal, was, you know, you don't have to pledge and then wait a few months. You get to play now. And in theory, people can exploit that by like canceling their pledge afterwards, whatever, but you know, nobody does that. And we were on Kickstarter almost 24/7. If somebody pledged, we would often send them an email containing a beta key within minutes. And, you know, we promised 24 hours, but often it was a couple of hours or less. And so, people were getting access to the game. They were really interested in it. They were playing it. We had people blog about it and say really awesome things. We ran various promotions. We got a bunch of streamers from Hearthstone to play a tournament in Prismata. We tried Reddit ads. They did okay. Facebook ads didn't do well at all. I mean, overall, it got a lot of attention. It got a lot of people playing the game. And now we have a substantial user base that we can actually, like, query for feedback and test things on. And the money is definitely good. It definitely helps us make a lot of progress. And, you know, we can use that money to fund improvements to the art and the sound and stuff like that, which is really important to us. But the actual most important thing by far is the community that we built as a result of running this Kickstarter.
I mean,
you know, like last.
Oh, what I was going to say is I just want to point out that I think what's really awesome, and I'm not sure if other Kickstarter campaigns do this, is that you actually provided the value right when they pledged. Like, there was no risk. Like, you reduced a lot of the risk by just providing them something that relates to what they were interested in right away with those keys.
Well, I think Kickstarter's got such a bad name in the last couple of years. Like, I feel like in 2012, we could have had no product and made, like, twice as much as we made.
Yeah.
You know, and Kickstarter's got such a bad name because of these publishers or whatever who have done a Kickstarter and then not delivered. And so I almost felt that, like, in order to avoid that issue, we should just deliver right away. And find a way of doing that. And it was something we really wanted to do. And we, like, you know, we pushed our team, like, get the back end ready, make sure the server can scale. And we had like WoW supplies last on the instant access keys because we were petrified of having too many users and having our server, like, degrade in its experience. And there was one point where we hit like 85% server CPU load. And if it hits 100, then it starts to lag. And so we were nervous that we'd have to stop sending people keys. But fortunately, like throughout the month, even during the Kickstarter, we made improvements to the server that helped fix those problems. So we were able to keep giving the instant access keys out.
Yeah. And I think the whole Kickstarter thing also brings up a good point is that, like you said, if you would have done it 2 years ago with no product, people would have just funded it for no reason. I mean, okay, I'm exaggerating a little, but they were more open to it. And I think that's why I mentioned some of these other distribution platforms, because if you get in early, it allows you to get more exposure in a way that's unexpected, right? Because people there's nothing else out there, right? And so what's happened now with Kickstarter is that it seems like it's become much more saturated and you have to stand out. And even if you stand out, you may not even get as much as what was there before, but you know, like, and your team has done that really well with just offering that, you know, like, hey, here's a key, here's a great way to show that, okay, this is actually going to happen. So
yeah, like even with the success of our Kickstarter campaign, we didn't really generate that much in terms of pledges from Kickstarter itself. Most of the backers came from Reddit or came from our existing player pool. It wasn't really the case that we had random passers-by who were in Kickstarter slash games or whatever and stumbled upon us.
Okay.
And I think that's something people gotta realize. You gotta create your own fan base. You can't just expect people to come anymore.
Yeah. And so after that Kickstarter campaign then, I mean, what was your team thinking then in terms of where the game needs to go and what the opportunity or you know, what's the best strategy moving forward?
Yeah, so here's basically what happened. The Kickstarter ended December 20th. We all took a nice long Christmas vacation. We came back in January, and there's now a board in the office which has like dozens of sticky notes, which is essentially everything we want to work on in the next couple of months. And you know, there's tons of stuff there, but basically it's listing all that stuff, prioritizing it, looking at production, looking at like what additional art assets and sound assets. Like the game has no sound at all. We're getting sound. You know, every single category. What can we do? What is the best way to most efficiently spend our resources, and work on new features of the game, build stuff into the game that people want. We put out a survey to see what people actually want us to work on. And of course, we've been working on a single player campaign kind of behind the scenes for ages now. It still feels like it's going to be forever before it's ready, but we are crawling closer and closer all the time.
And how
And our goal is to have it out by summer, I would hope.
And how important do you feel the single player campaign is? I know you mentioned that there needed to be some kind of single player component so that people could onboard more easily.
Yeah, right. Right now, our new user experience still kind of sucks. And the reason is basically in order to learn the game, people have to watch a YouTube video. And some people just don't want to do that, or and they don't want to play tutorials that feel like homework. Making a good tutorial for a game like ours, which, you know, it can't piggyback on other games of similar genres and say, oh, our game's just like this. The game is an entirely new game, new genre, new game mechanics, and people do need to learn them all from scratch. So we need to build a compelling tutorial, and that's a highly iterative process. You make one iteration of the tutorial, you test it on people, you see how they react, you do it again and again and again and again. And we've started from scratch on the tutorial a number of times too, just because we felt that a certain way of developing the early missions isn't working. We have a writer working with us. We're building a full narrative into the single player campaign. And you know, we felt the narrative hook, anything that we can do that increases the sort of stickiness of the game to new players, we want to do. And it's in some ways the most important thing for us is to make sure that people who try the game actually stick with us. Because in the end, those are going to be your customers. You have to make sure you retain them.
And okay, and so what I guess, yeah, moving forward, I guess, are there any other things that you're going to be considering, any other, I guess, surprises or new directions that that I guess you've now considered given your experiences from the past year? You mentioned going to conventions. Do you feel that that's an effective thing in terms of marketing a game, or is it mainly online now?
Well, we went to Fan Expo last year, which resulted in us blowing a whole lot of money, eventually losing the mailing list, and overall it was a bit of a bust. I think it's highly luck-based. I mean, stuff related to journalism is, in general, highly luck-based. If you can find one journalist who has a lot of exposure and views your game favorably, then, you know, potentially you can exploit that for years and years and years to get favorable coverage. And every time you're doing something new, you can get even more coverage. And I think building those relationships is important, but it's both, one, highly luck-based, and two, is something that you don't see a return on for years. And I think there are ways of doing it without conventions. Like you don't need to physically meet up with people in order to teach them the game. But it definitely can help. And I think it's probably better to go in having some kind of established relationships. Like now, when we went to Fan Expo, we didn't really know anybody. You know, we knew some people in the industry, but we didn't really know people who are journalists or would cover us. And to be honest, there wasn't a lot of that at Fan Expo because a lot of the media there was focused on the like celebrities that show up to sign things, and there's a lot of like actors and movie folks there too. If I had to do it again, you know, we might go to something like PAX or whatever, and mostly focus. Like, we wouldn't even need to have a booth there. It would be mostly the case of booking press appointments and trying to actually engage with people who would give us coverage, and a lot of just planning before we even would go there. You know, and we're definitely considering it. PAX East being in Boston, which is where MIT is, it's pretty easy for us to get down there, and we could just show up and try and get some press appointments. I don't know if we'll end up doing it, but it's more on the radar. But in terms of like having a big presence at a lot of trade shows, I think it's a good way to spend a lot of money without a good return. If you don't know what you're doing, or you don't have a clear goal and why you're doing it.
Yeah, and even the concept of journalist is or effective journalist is changing. I mean, if you think of some of the games, at least that have hit mainstream last year, it's primarily because of coverage from these YouTube reviewers, you know, like PewDiePie or some of these new.
Well,
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's even changing.
Okay.
We focus most of our attempts at promotion on two platforms, Reddit and Twitch.
So
And
Twitch is big.
for a game like ours, I think streaming is almost bigger than YouTubers, because if people are going to continually play your game and people are going to watch them play the game, they want to play it. But in particular, the way it spreads and the way it creates a community around a particular streamer or a particular person playing the game, I think it's much more conducive to growing a community. On YouTube, it's sort of like a crapshoot, or it's luck-based. And I think it's almost a bubble that's bursting, because we've seen these games like these sort of PewDiePie games, they call them, or games that are created deliberately with the intention of getting YouTubers to play them. They don't necessarily sell well. Like, there's lots of games that PewDiePie played that still nobody wants to play, because the game is just made to be something that like PewDiePie dies repeatedly in and gets laughed at. Like, it's not necessarily a compelling experience. Whereas I think on a platform like Twitch, being something that gets play on Twitch is much more highly correlated with actually being a game that people want to buy and play themselves. Whereas on YouTube, it's less correlated. So I think Twitch is a better platform.
And what do you think about these other platforms that are kind of competitors to Twitch? Is that something you also consider, or is it just mainly not Twitch?
You mean other streaming services?
Yeah,
Like,
exactly. Because I think some of these have popped up. I don't know them specifically. I just read them in passing.
well, there's like Hitbox and Livestream, and in, you know, by any metric that you can check, Twitch is by far and away the market leader, and the second place is so far back that it's almost not worth considering. Like, in terms of streaming, Twitch is the be all and end all right now, at least.
So, as I mean, it's amazing that you know you have this unique game and this game set. And so the question is how are you going to like carve out a very solid foundation, you know, in the game design space or the game space, similar to like say Magic the Gathering or something else, around your game. You know, I know you're doing that right now, building the community and stuff like that. I mean, where do you see and you may not even want to discuss, I guess, where the ambition is for your game or your company at this point. But what do you see, I guess, your studio needs to do moving forward, at least in the next maybe 1 to 5 years?
Well, with something like Magic: The Gathering, they basically created a completely new business model from scratch, and
Exactly.
that's not really what we're trying to do, in terms of innovating on the business model. In terms of innovating on the game design, that's definitely true. There's a lot of target markets that we see ourselves being very successful in. A lot of people who play Hearthstone, they kind of, it wasn't really what they were looking for, or maybe they want the game to be a bit more deep or a bit more challenging or a bit less random. There's a lot of ways in which we try and differentiate ourselves from these products, making the narrative of the game a sci-fi narrative instead of a fantasy narrative. We do try to make a conscientious effort to carve out a bit of a niche and not just be a clone of another game. And I mean, that's true in the game design as well. But there's definitely a lot of people who, when they hear about Prismata or what it's about, and when we tell them, when we describe the game to them in a certain way, they become interested and they want to try the game. And so I think for us, the most important thing is just making sure that the gameplay experience that they get is actually good, and making sure that it's as easy as possible for people to just get into the game and try it and have a good experience with it.
And are you
I
going to
mean,
have
like
yeah.
we've talked to streamers, and like we have prominent Hearthstone streamers like Kriparian and Kalento that just play the game for fun. They don't necessarily stream it or make videos or anything like that. But they climb the ladder. They actually just enjoy playing the game. And fundamentally, if we can make a game that is sufficiently enjoyable that these types of players will want to play it, then our hope is that success will naturally follow through them evangelizing the game or streaming the game or having fan bases that already exist and are willing to try a game that, the person they like to watch is interested in. So that's sort of, I guess, our goal. It's mostly just make a game that's really good.
You mentioned streaming, and I just want to bring up something else that I've just noticed, as a trend, and it's probably already passed, but it seems like some of the really successful games kind of build these financial ecosystems where streamers are literally their full-time job is covering, streaming content related to that game, or there are tournaments where, there's so much money involved, it's like an esport, right? And there's so much buzz around that, right? Like $10 million prize money or something else like that, which it's amazing to hear about those things. What are your thoughts in terms of esports and maybe people who are streaming that kind of feed into your ecosystem of your game, but also they're making a living off of it and stuff like that. So building this financial ecosystem where there are other players and actors who are doing different things that complement your game, but also allow them to do what, to make a living off of it.
Well, I mean, you got to be talking after a few years of growth, because in order for that to exist for your game already needs to be so popular that you can finance that. I think esports is definitely something that Prismata is a well-suited game for esports, and that's why we've built in tournament features and stuff like that. We do have people who run Prismata tournaments, and they stream them, and I think we've actually had sponsors for some Prismata tournaments. In terms of being a self-sustaining ecosystem, obviously we're not there yet. But I can see sometime this year, maybe crowdfunding a big tournament or something like that. And one roadblock is definitely, in order for people to want to stream the game, there needs to be better graphics, bigger audience, more appeal to the audience. Right now, when the audience watches people play Prismata, that they often don't even know what's going on. And in order to improve that, there's just tons and tons of things that still need to be done with regards to the appearance of the game and the way the user interface behaves and acts. And that's a big focus for us. We've actually added a number of streaming features, for example, to allow people to put cameras or stats or things on the battlefield and have the physical game components not slide under them. So you can like put your face cam on the game board and the units sort of wrap around it. We've added these types of features precisely to help our streamers. And there's a listing of all the people streaming the game right now in Prismata itself. We actually use the Twitch API for that.
That's amazing.
I, in all honesty, that feature, which is just a listing of who's streaming right now and how many people are watching them, that took me 3 hours from not having a clue about the Twitch API to actually having it done and in the game and working. Like it was very simple to do, but I think little things like that add so much value, and
Yeah.
they've really helped us quite a bit.
Well, yeah, even the concept of literally modifying your UI so that it's, you know, streamer friendly is something that I never even considered. So I think that's an amazing concept. And you know, the other thing I was going to think about with esports is, you know, you think of League of Legends and maybe watching that because, you know, yours is turn-based versus League of Legends, which is more, there's a lot more animation, I feel. And but then I was just thinking about poker. Right. And I know in your video you have some poker players in there, and you know people are watching poker, and it isn't like it's as animated as League of Legends. So the esports thing seems interesting, but where do you feel esports is going to go? Do you feel it's going to eclipse traditional current sports like football and basketball? And this is more, so we're going to talk now more about where you see the industry going and some of the trends in game design.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh man. It'll be a while before esports is more popular than football, but maybe not that long. I don't know. The fact that Hearthstone has become an esport, and I think it's probably in the top three or top four most streamed games on Twitch, and it's a relatively slow-paced, turn-based game. You know, it does show that people are willing to stream that type of game and watch that type of game on stream. I think that needing to have action, like something like League of Legends, the fact that it's five versus five, it's almost so difficult to see what's going on. There's sort of two ways that you can watch that. You can watch the casted League of Legends game, or you can watch a specific streamer themselves playing League of Legends. And in both cases, you're not seeing everything that's happening. A game like StarCraft, it's hard to see everything that's happening because so much is going on at once. Whereas a game like Hearthstone is actually very streamer friendly, comparatively speaking. And so we may see games that are developed more in line to be more streamer friendly and esports friendly. Like a game like Hearthstone, it actually took them a long time before they had an observer mode. And we ran our own Hearthstone tournaments, and it was a pain to stream them because there was no observing, you know. And the fact that like they didn't have that in the game from the get-go, it's sort of a tell that like their esports focus wasn't really there, and now they've shifted a bit. And I think we're going to see that with a lot of other games. You're going to see more streamer focus, more esports focus in the game development itself. Who was it? I think it was like Day9 who was giving a talk, and he compared Diablo 3's user interface to Path of Exile's user interface, and he basically said that like, you know, the problem with PoE's UI was that there's no place to put your face cam when you're playing the game, and you know, it's like a serious flaw in the actual user interface design because there's important stuff in all four corners of the screen, so you can't put your camera there. And little things like that, I think we're going to see a big change in the way games are developed.
And I guess in terms of structural design of the game itself, I mean, do you feel you're pretty clear now on exactly where the main areas of focus need to be? Do you feel there are going to be any fundamental shifts, I guess, in terms of approach or structure related to it? And so, for example, like the single player campaign, that's something that's not prevalent now, but adding that could make a huge difference, right? In terms of the game experience, obviously, and something else. You talked about having monthly updates, and that may not necessarily make huge structural differences to the whole, to the onboarding or something else like that. I mean, are there any other massive structural things that you're considering that you can discuss at this point?
Yeah, I can talk about anything. We considered raids for a long time, like PvE content, where you make a party of your friends and you fight against a boss that spawns waves of enemies. And we actually built them and we played them, and they're a tremendous amount of fun. And we're looking to add them to the game, you know, basically when the campaign's in a good state, or when the onboarding's in a good state. Because I think PvE has a number of benefits. It's a very social experience. There's certain types of gamers who want that social experience out of their game. It's very viral because people ask their friends to play. It helps with monetization if you can have gifting and you can have you know, mechanics where like one player in the party buys a power up that gives more rewards to everyone in the party. These are very good for monetization. There's a lot of different directions that we could go in. If our single player content's really good, then we could just like make all of our money selling single player expansions. I don't know if that'll be the ultimate direction, but we like to remain open to all kinds of different ways that the game can develop. There are many games like, you know, TF2 went to free to play, and there's so many games that have undergone big pivots in the way that they monetize. And I think we have right now like three or four different ways that we can potentially monetize, with single player content, with skins, with stuff related to raids. We're going to build sort of an arena mode into the game, something similar to what Hearthstone has, although obviously not the same because there's no decks. But the idea being that there's tons and tons of different ways that we can develop the game, and we don't know what's going to be the optimal or the most fun or the, you know, the most profitable or whatever. We're just going to experiment a lot, and I think we have a community that's really willing to accept that. Like we added this feature into the game called Grandmaster Mode, and what it is it's like a fixed set of Prismata units that you can play with over and over again, and it literally is like a chess game where you could memorize openings with a specific set of units. And we just put it out there to see if anybody would take interest in it. And you know, basically people didn't like it, so it'll get cut. And we're okay with that. We're okay with throwing away ideas that don't end up panning out. But we do a lot of those types of experiments, and I think a lot of other games are unwilling to take those type of risks because they see it as like, oh, we can't admit that we're wrong about something in design, or we can't take away a feature that we used to have. People won't like that. They feel like they have to support a feature forever once they have it at once, and we don't feel that way.
And so what is the balance between, I guess, you talked about priorities before and, what you prioritize each day. I mean, where's the balance between, I guess, the percentage of time you spend marketing versus distribution versus innovation, experimenting with new game design concepts versus execution of current concepts and current tasks?
I don't know. I mean, we're reevaluating all the time. Marketing we're slowing way down on until single player's done, and then we'll probably have another big push. A lot of our marketing efforts are currently geared around our existing community, trying to sort of motivate them to play the game more, give us more feedback, share the game with their friends. Like a lot of we still have a crowdfunding site up. You can still get a supporter pack for Prismata even though the Kickstarter is over. And most of the people who are doing that, it's like a word of mouth. They have a friend who plays the game and referred them, type of thing. Or they were a previous player and they never supported us, and now they become a supporter. So that's what we're focusing on right now, in terms of marketing versus development. I mean, we're obviously developing new features all the time. In terms of innovating and trying new stuff out, we kind of do that like for fun on the weekend almost. You know, we'll have office parties, and it's like, okay, we're gonna raid tonight, and we're gonna try a new, different type of raid that we've never tried before. And somebody will spend, you know, half a day developing this new type of raid, and it's sort of meant to be throwaway, but we just try it, and it's like, oh, that was really interesting, or this specific aspect of it was really fun. And the same thing with missions. Like often, you know, I'll be just sitting around doing nothing, and I'll think about an idea for a mission, and I have a notebook, and I just write it down, and maybe develop it a bit further. And often, you can put together the pieces without actually building it. You can just do it in sort of a pencil and paper fashion, and it's something you can do anytime. And a lot of these ideas that we sort of come up with randomly ended up getting cobbled together to form the campaign. And there's still aspects of that structure that are not fully formed yet, but a lot of it's very incremental and sort of gradual, I guess.
And so now we're towards the end of the interview, and I'm just going to ask you some, I guess, some suggestions for indie game developers that want to make their own games. I guess, like, what are the top three lessons that you wish you would have known as you started this? I know you got a lot of advice from other people already, but maybe there were some surprises that you still didn't expect that you wish you would have known that would have made things more effective in terms of growing your studio and developing it.
I don't know. I mean, I basically what I already said, you know, work with good people. I think here's one. One is throw away your bad ideas as fast as possible. This is something I've discovered working with game developers. They have egos. They often want to defend their bad ideas. They'll make an idea and they'll think it's good, and then for whatever reason they'll discover it's bad, but they'll keep trying to tweak it or improve it or make it better, and sometimes it's just ultimately a bad idea. And often when you are trying to solve a design problem or trying to come up with a good idea or something, the most time effective way to do that is to try ideas that are very different from each other, as different as possible, even ideas that you don't think will necessarily be good. And one, detach your ego from your idea. You're not criticizing a person when you're criticizing their idea. You're just saying this idea sucks. And if you yourself come up with ideas that you don't necessarily think are good, but you're willing to try them just because the process of trying it will teach you something, that's sort of more valuable, right? So learning to throw away your ideas, your bad ideas quickly, trying new ideas that are as different as possible from your current ones. Like often when we would want to like change up a unit in Prismata, we'd think, oh, it's a bit too strong. Let's make it cost $1 more. Like, don't do that. Make it cost like $3 more. Buff or nerf stuff aggressively in order to find the balance point faster or learn more about what the true sort of value is. And stuff like that, I think, helps you just move faster, develop things faster. Don't work on polishing stuff if you don't even know that it's going to be in the final product. And that's hard for a lot of people to do because people are perfectionists. It's also hard to evaluate some types of ideas because maybe if it was polished more, it would be better. But often you can get a feel, and I think the amount you can learn about whether an idea is good, is sort of it's a diminishing function of how much you spend trying to execute that. Like, you can build a crappy version of something just to evaluate whether or not it's good. And maybe you'll decide that, oh, we need to refine it more in order to determine whether or not it's good. But often you don't need to spend nearly as much time as you think you do in order to like test your design decisions or improve your designs. I think that's sort of one of the biggest things I've learned. Like, try to iterate as fast as possible. And the question that you should always be asking yourself is, what do I try next? It's never like, is this idea good or is it bad? It's just, what do I try next? And if the thing you try next is this idea with some modification, then that's fine. But don't spend like hours arguing about an idea. Just decide what to try next. And it doesn't even matter because you can try the other thing later. Just decide what to try next and then try it.
Great. And so for the listeners out there, once again, where can they find out more information about Prismata and potentially check out the, play it and stuff like that?
Yeah, so Prismata.net is our it's right now it's just got a video up and a couple of links, one of which is to the Kickstarter page, which the Kickstarter is over, but there's still tons of information there. There's a link to a demo which you can play. If you want to actually get in on the alpha, we still are giving instant access to Prismata supporters. So if you go to Prismata.net, there's a link there. Anybody can sign up for the beta, and we send out keys every once in a while. I don't know when we'll actually be in beta. The distinction between alpha and beta and finally released is sort of, smaller than it's ever been with these types of online free-to-play games. But anyways, the Reddit community is reddit.com/r/Prismata. There's tons of people there talking about the game. If anybody's interested in just like learning about what the game is, there's people there more than willing to answer any question. If you just want to talk to me, my email is up on the Prismata website. We have a company website as well, which is lunarkstudios.com, which there's a link to it on there as well. I don't know. Any other questions that I should be answering?
No, that's it. That's great. Thanks very much, and thanks again for sharing with us the your current studio's progress and stuff like that.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm willing to talk to anybody about the game or anything related to the game pretty much at any time. You know, if people have suggestions or they want to learn more about the game or they want some key to give away to their friends, you know, I'm more than happy to entertain any kind of discussion. I try to be as open as possible. Like if people send me a PM on Reddit, I like actually will reply to it all the time. So people can do that.
Cool. Thanks again. Take care.
All right, see you later.
Take care.
Bye.